welcome to this week's Bowler's Desk Political Podcast with me, Matt Bowler, and Rick Epps of the BowlersDesk.com Political Podcast. This time, we met over at the Union Station, also known as Santa Fe Station, in downtown San Diego. It was first built in 1887 to help run people up that were building the Panama Canal. It's very kind of cool. San Diego had a real direct connection to that. It's this cool Victorian-era Spanish-style structure. We were outside, out near the fountain, so you hear all the fountain and the trolley and the traffic, and every now and then a person or two. It's kind of a cool place to just sort of hang out and have a cup of coffee and people watch. I kind of like going down there. Very interesting people watching, to say the least. This time around, we also had Jack Anderson. Jack Anderson is a software developer. I thought it would be interesting to get somebody's opinion on the whole Snowden situation from someone who makes software, from someone who potentially could have been hired to be Snowden, although Jack finished college, and I think Snowden was a high school dropout and more of an autodidactic as far as software computer technology is concerned. Jack is definitely self-taught with a lot of things, but he studied this and he works in it professionally. And he talked about network analysis and how it works and shared his opinions based on his perspective. And it was, you know, it was a lot of fun. It was a very interesting and enlightening conversation. And, you know, as always, if you hear something that makes you want to hop on your soapbox, you can do that by hopping on ours. Just give us a call, 619-663-4531, 619-663-4531. Leave us a message and tell us what you think. We're always happy to hear from people out in the world. So, this time we talked about everything, local, national, international, and then a focus on Snowden. BowlersDesk.com political podcast with me, Matt Bowler, and San Diego's political professor, Rick Epps, from the Union Station or Santa Fe Station in downtown San Diego. I hope you enjoy it. Come back off. So, yeah, so with the train station,
you can see
the Union train station.
Santa Fe. Look at that architecture, man. And look at the architecture, you know, how beautiful the architecture is, though. And you don't do that anymore. What we do now is glass and steel.
Well, it's cheaper. That kind of modernist stuff is a lot cheaper, and you can prefab most of it.
You know, it's funny. When I was a kid, I used to love the sci-fi look of that stuff. Now I've really come to appreciate much more the aesthetics of the quality of that.
Artistically, that architecture talks to human beings at a human scale.
Yeah.
Whereas the other kind of the newer stuff, the big flat facades, talk to groups of people.
Yeah.
So it's like a real conceptual shift as far as who an architect's audience is.
Exactly.
So architects are not talking to individuals anymore, and I think there's a shift, and I think that represents a larger kind of cultural shift.
You know what's interesting about that? You just brought something to mind. Back in the 1920s, 1930s, they had the Art Deco look, and the buildings were very ornate, and they were very interesting.
Yeah.
And then by the 50s, they started building, I mean, even at San Diego State, mm-hmm. you notice that the 50s style architecture, mid to late 50s, they started doing these very very angular, sort of just more utilitarian type of buildings that weren't very sexy, but they were just.
Well, think about all the craftsmen they just got rid of having a facade.
Well, but here's the thing about that.
It's a great way of crushing unions.
Well, yeah, it is. But here's the thing. When you look at these buildings, they're kind of a modern version of the 1950s buildings that were just built out of utility, but not with any sort of substance to them.
Yeah.
And these same with these buildings. Most of them don't have a lot of substance. Yeah, they put a few angles on them, and they put a few tricks and bells and whistles to make them look, like really high-techy. But in terms of personality and something that draws you in, they're just
something. They look good from airplanes.
Yeah.
And they only talk to groups. So you're not an individual with this kind of architecture.
Yeah, you're not.
You're a member of a group.
Yeah, you're kind of part of the machinery.
Yeah.
That's what you become here.
That's what it's about. And that's really what it's about.
I struggle with that.
Yeah, who doesn't?
Well, it's funny. But you have to evolve to that. I mean, there was a time when I didn't. I thought, oh, wow, it's cool.
It was shiny. Yeah, shiny and pretty.
And now I realize that all the glitters ain't
gold. Yeah, well, everything in, like, what, every Buck Rogers episode kind of had that same kind of look, right?
Oh, man.
From back in the, I've seen them on Netflix.
I actually have the old, I have some DVDs that I bought from when I was, from back in the day when I was a kid. That were old Buck, Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I laugh at it because I look at it now with the little sparks coming out of the back of the spaceship.
Yeah.
I thought back in the day that was like really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you look at it and go, wow.
That song.
Wow. You can see the little string, the little lines dangling the spaceship on this trying flying around.
That 80s Flash Gordon.
No, this is like, this is the old from back in the 1930s of Buster Crabbe, old version. It's pretty funny, man.
Yeah.
Good stuff, though. Good stuff, you know.
So do you think Filner's going to take the train back from rehab, seeing how he got out of rehab early?
Well, I think he, now that he's been healed, I think he's probably on his way.
He's been healed.
He's going to take the train to the border
and
keep going.
Yeah, I know. I think what happened was, is he was in rehab. He was a week in and realized it wasn't doing any good politically or professionally for him.
Yeah.
It wasn't doing any good with the potential criminal case against him. And so he just decided, fuck it, I don't need the rest of this. I'm just going to go back. And he may end up quitting at some point this week.
Yeah, I think...
Because it's not doing what... He thought people would buy it.
Yeah. I mean, at first I thought people would buy it after, you know, 2 weeks. That was bad enough. But I think with the more, with the numerous allegations that are coming forward even more, the tape recording, it really... I mean, you know, even though, I still maintain he deserves his day in court. I mean, that's part of our...
Yeah, but there's a difference between... A day in court for a criminal thing,
and tying up the whole city,
with the political reality of the situation.
Yeah,
those are two different situations entirely.
Absolutely, I agree.
You know, and his due process within the context of HR and the city kind of government is that's him going into talking to the HR people, and he'd already admitted to doing this, so he's had his due process within that context already.
Exactly,
and that's a separate issue from the civil and the criminal part of the whole thing. And
exactly.
I think a lot of people, and especially the due process type people, are miss that.
And here's the thing that's going to happen. There's so much distraction that it's for the time it's going to take him to navigate the waters, even if he survived this, the time it's going to take him to navigate the waters to get through this is going to be so long that it's going to keep the city hamstrung to him for a year plus. To get through the net. I mean, so it really isn't fair to San Diego and to San Diegans for him to have to deal with that. And I don't, you know, it's unfortunate. I mean, I'm not happy about this happening to him. It's just the fact that now that it's happened, it's a reality. We have to, the city has to move on. And I think, you know, he's got to do the right thing.
The best thing for him to do would be to quit and then let Todd Gloria take it over. And then we just, because there's only 2 years left in his. Or wait, no, he's only 6 months, 8 months in.
He's got three.
Thinking that it feels like. So maybe we have an election and just kind of reboot the whole system.
I mean, we have to, we have to. But, I mean, that's the way it should run. And if he's, you know, if he's trying to do the right thing or has any sort of crisis of conscience, hopefully he'll do that. He'll step away and, you know, go get some real help and, you know, fade into the limelight so he can kind of try and get this behind him and move on in his life.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully.
So the state attorney general's the one handling any criminal investigation. You know, I've heard they may move this week. Lee, his new chief of staff, she went and changed all the locks this past week. And she said it was because she wanted to make sure that anybody who may have been working there before that quit because he was harassing them couldn't just come back into the office and remove evidence. Well, what it also means is that investigators now have to get her to go through because nobody's got keys but her.
Yeah.
So now they have to go get her to get in there and they have to go. She's involved if they serve a search warrant this week. Which is what that really, the problem that's what that really deals with there.
Yeah, but you know they've got eyes, so if anything comes out of that office that's not supposed to come out of that office, they'll know. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, they can't just, but, you know.
Problematic.
I don't think that she's going to destroy evidence. I don't think she would do anything like that.
No, I don't think
so. Or remove anything. I think that maybe people who work there or work there still that don't understand what they're doing would do that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they would pull it out.
Yeah.
Well, maybe later. We're in the middle of something right now.
Recording right now.
But after,
well, give us just a few minutes, and then we'll
after we're done.
Okay. No worries.
Okay.
No worries.
Okay.
No,
that's
okay.
Fine.
Don't worry.
All right.
Yeah, go have a seat right over there, and then we'll come find you when we're done. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Uh huh. It's okay.
No worries.
So. Apparently, yeah. Yeah, yeah. The guard tried to tell him he couldn't sleep or drink here.
Yeah.
And
he's already had enough to drink.
Yeah, he's definitely had enough to drink.
Yeah.
So I don't think she would do that, but I think people that work there still. Through this whole thing, may have inadvertently or without understanding what they're doing, mm-hmm. possibly, you know, done stuff to kind of aid him in hiding evidence or moving things, totally without knowing that that's what they were doing.
Exactly.
I could see him manipulating groups of people into doing that, or manipulating a person into doing that.
Yeah, especially if he knew the tip of the iceberg, potentially he could say, hey, could you go get this for me, pick this up for me, grab that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're not
saying,
gonna,
sure,
yeah.
you know, I mean, yeah. thinking that, you know.
You know, who knew what when, right?
Yeah.
That's what I want to know.
Yeah, and
who
the thing
what,
is, I don't
when
know if we'll ever
it?
Get to the answer for all of it, but I think that it's become such a huge negative distraction at this point that he's not going to survive it. You know, I mean, I just think his
and it's
legacy.
It's kind of the only local news there is.
Yeah, so if it was, there was something else going on, we'd be...
Maybe you can sneak things things by right now. I mean, now's a good time to be sneaky and try and push things through, and nobody will notice.
Exactly, because he's being too much of a distraction. I think that's the biggest problem.
So,
you know, one of the things I think is interesting about this is the fact that it really just shows how it really does give you an insight into the sort of power politics and what the seduction of power and just what it can do and sort of the ego that goes along with some of that is pretty damning, you know, to can even some of the best of people get swept away when they get into these positions and they realize they can, you know, their humanness as men and women sort of are subverted by the power vacuum, you know?
Yeah, because he'd been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
This is not new. And,
you
know, maybe this started to really happen when he divorced his first wife.
Yeah.
You know, and then apparently his fiance, you know, there's all kinds of rumors about what she was aware of, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
and
who
again,
knows?
I think some of the, you know, and again, part of it is what happens because of the, I mean, the sad part is you're going to have people who are involved simply because they just want to, you know, who just want to write a book and make money.
Yeah.
And there are people who are actively involved because they really are angry about the effect that what he did had on them. You know, and I think most people are standing that second part of that. But, you know, there's always people who are, you know, looking, there's always some economic benefit. And like we said last week, the question was, why now for some people who to wait so long? And I think that's really a good question that really hasn't been answered
yet. I mean, these women that were, you know, rape victims that he was coming on to.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I wonder how much of this behavior is just lecherous and crass and you know, versus illegal.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, and that becomes, that's the question.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
This woman that came forward saying that to help this veteran, saying that she alleged that if she went out with him, he would help this Marine veteran that she was working for or taking care of. I don't quite understand that.
Yeah.
You know, that there was some sort of quid pro quo implication there.
See, but that's...
Now, I'm not 100% sure, you know, what really happened in that situation. Now, maybe she's got evidence that she hasn't released yet.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't think that a lawyer would pursue a lawsuit like that without evidence.
Yeah, so. You think that? I mean, you'd be risking your legal career if you went down that road without having something, you know,
and
to cooperate.
They're definitely working towards a settlement on that one. I mean, Allred never goes to court.
Yeah,
exactly. She doesn't. Gloria, she never goes to court. She's looking for a settlement. She'll take a good settlement.
Yeah, which who'll have to pay it?
Yeah, well, the city.
Yeah, exactly.
Will have to pay it.
Yeah. So, once again,
for what was done in the 6 months he's been in office, roughly 8 months, 6 to 8 months.
They won't have to go any further than that? You don't think they'll be able to go after the city for any...
He wasn't in office then, so he wasn't a manager then. He was in Congress for the stuff he did before.
Okay, so they can go after the federal government. They can go after the federal government.
They can't sue the city for something he, you know. So maybe they can sue the federal. I don't even know what you could sue the federal government for.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? See, the only reason Allred took it was because this woman went to see Filner when he was in Congress.
Yeah.
And then she, you know, this thing happened. Then she went back to see him when he was mayor.
Yeah.
After he became elected mayor.
Yeah.
So, you know, what is the city on the hook for?
Yeah.
I mean, this is going to tie up legally, and it's going to cost hundreds millions of dollars.
Exactly, which is unfortunate because we don't have it to spend. You know?
No, we don't. We should spend it on other things.
So it becomes a real problem because of that as well. So,
yeah.
You know, so that's what we'll have to wait and see. Yeah. Okay.
So.
Thanks.
The danger.
We get all kinds of interesting people down here in downtown, at Broadway, at foot of Broadway, and Kettner.
And decide that we're going to solve their problems for them.
Yeah, we can't even solve our own. We're just trying to talk about them so we can get them out there, right? Yeah.
So Obama was in Russia.
Yeah.
Talking to Putin. And, I mean, I don't think Obama is giving two shits about Snowden in Russia at this point. It's an embarrassment. You know, he wants to, you know, I'm sure he wants to prosecute him. The Obama administration loves to prosecute people.
Yeah.
They've gone after, I think, twice as many. They've gone after more people on the federal level than all other presidents combined since George Bush Senior, the father. So they love to prosecute people.
Yeah, they do. It's interesting, this whole Russian-U.S. issue now. I mean, there's multiple things that are driving it, right? You've got North Korea, you've got Iran, you've got Syria, you've got Afghanistan, you know, you've got Snowden. You've got five things right now that tick.
What about the Olympics?
Well, the weird homophobic law
that was just passed?
Yeah.
And Putin threatening to arrest any Olympic athlete that demonstrated any pro-gay rights
in any way,
they were pro-gay rights.
And here's the thing about these six issues. On the political scale of things that happen, are they important? Absolutely. On the big picture scale, this is just politics. You know, it's just politics as usual. And what happens, a lot of times what may appear big to us is not. If you look at the big political picture, Putin and Obama being pissed at each other and not being BFFs for a month or so, maybe even a couple months, where they're not having tea together, is not as important as both of them recognizing the big picture, because they both want the global economy to stay static. They both want grow. They want stability. And so those are the driving big picture issues that supersede everything. All the little things that happen below there, it may sound silly to say, but are smaller items on the agenda. These are for agendas for everyday people. The big picture, not that big a deal to those people.
Yeah, yeah. The Snowden thing did have an effect, right?
Well, it had an effect.
Congress even was voting on funding or defunding programs for the NSA. And
yeah, people, they won't do that.
It was split. It was not a decisive vote. And it was split, and it was really diverse party-wise. It was not like Republicans, Democrats voted this way, and it wasn't like, abstention and one against versus everyone else for. People seem totally confused about what he did, how he did it, and then what effect that is having, and whether or not these programs should continue and what these programs mean.
Well, I'll tell you why I said what I said. I love being a little controversial here, because what just happened last week with all the terror alerts and how they picked up the traffic.
Conveniently timed,
exactly,
right?
Because now it shows that if you shut down, not really literally shut down, but if you shut off the NSA and what it does and the way it does it, then perhaps you don't get access to the information that at least got the terror alert out there. Now, of course, we know nothing has happened as of yet directly. Mm-hmm. However, it does recognize the potential for, like it or not, having those surveillance mechanisms in place is,
Because that's chatter. When they say chatter, that's how they find this stuff.
Exactly. And we, I mean, not just our chatter. We get chatter from all of our allies, too. So it's not just us by ourselves picking up chatter. It's the chatter we get from the British intelligence, from Israeli intelligence, from all the other apparatus as well. We share in this information. So, if you know, so the idea is that, do you say, yeah, you know, we, what we do on a certain level may not, may be problematic, like with the issue with Snowden, right? Or but also do you say, but look at the advantages outweigh the negatives, you know, and that's what this kind of pushes you back to. Because I guarantee you, if you ran that through Congress again right now, I bet you have a few more people who would not be on the fence about it, or wouldn't be quite as equally split as it is, right, as it happens to have stood the other day.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I just think it would be a little bit different because that changes that dynamic.
Yeah, it does.
You know?
It does, right?
You know, it changes the argument. Funny how that is, though.
And so we'll loop back around later. We have our a computer.
We have our esteemed guest
official,
here today.
Official nerd in here. Yeah. In just a second. But we want to. I want to talk about. Yeah. I want to talk about Cairo and today.
Yep.
Military is moving in to move the
Morsi
the Morsi pro-Morsi protesters now,
yeah,
who are occupying you know, all of the public spaces there, yeah, Tahrir Square and places like that. So it's just funny to me how there's that many pro-Morsi, and then just a few months ago it was that same amount anti-Morsi, and the military seems to be caught in between all of these people.
Well, yeah, but remember, now in Cairo, you've got, you know, what, 10 million people, right? Or no, more than, well, actually more than Cairo. But here's the thing that happens. You've got...
Because everybody got the impression from the first set of protests that this was a decisive decision by the vast majority of Egyptians.
Yeah.
You know,
it's probably not
the case.
No, it's actually probably more evenly split than people realize. But here's what happens. You have the Egyptians that are the middle class, upper class Egyptians, those that are more moderate or Islamists, that are, you know, that didn't want to see a group like the Muslim Brotherhood come to power, you know, that you had that group of people along with the secular Egyptians, and then you had the other groups of Egyptians who were more fundamentalist, usually on the poor economic scale, that you know, some of those who live in the more rural areas of Egypt, and then so you have an interesting sort of dichotomy within the region, within the country.
So what's the demo of the person now, protesting now? What's the demo of the pro-Morsi person?
I would say what you're seeing are the Muslim fundamentalists who, you know, who are sort of anti-secularism. I think you're seeing those that tend to be in the lower economic strata,
Is that why we're not seeing as much activity on this on, like, Twitter and Instagram and YouTube?
Yeah, I would say I think that's exactly the case. Not that they're all poor, but, I mean, you have middle-class fundamentalists, too.
There's a digital divide there,
exactly,
definitely.
Exactly. Yeah. And then what happens, the military comes in to have to, and I think in Egypt, that military serves an important role. If you didn't have that military in Egypt, you'd have a civil crisis of epic proportions in that country. So
they seem to be keeping a lid on everybody right now.
Yeah, and that's what they have to do. And I mean, many people think that it's just because they think the Egyptian military wants to have power. And I don't think that's really the case. I think they realize that they're the only mechanism in that country that keeps it from either going, because I think if there wasn't there, they'd probably be pushed into more of an Islamic theocracy, much more than the chances for seeing a secular democracy take fruit in that country. I don't think you'll ever have a pure secular democracy in the Middle East anyway. I don't think it's fundamentally possible. Not with the pushback from Islam. Even modern Islam, which tends to be, you know, much more tolerant, is still, you know, dealing with, when you talk about secularism and westernization, it's still a big pill for them to swallow to look at, you know, what we
call
westernization.
It's just funny how you take Muslims out of the Middle East and they come to the States and they have no problem with a secular democracy, no problem kind of living in the Western world.
Well, they kind of do their own thing.
With a similar context that we do.
Yeah, well, they kind of live, they still live a little bit isolated lives. They kind of look at it, but they try and stay away from it. It's a very closed society, it's like a sub-society within society. There are those who are more modern who mingle, but a lot of those who aren't still live in very closed existence. Mm-hmm. Their only world is within their mosque. And again, a lot of them, some of the mosques here have people who are in the lower economic strata, still new to the country. A lot of them are first, second generation, so they're really struggling with, you know, kind of how they fit into this, to all this.
Yeah.
You know, now, we struggle with trying to fit into all of it. So imagine for those who come from a different orientation, both with the ideas of religion and you know, and just how they live their lives. And I could see this would scare the hell out of them, you know?
Yeah.
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 That's part
so of the problem. a lot of the bigger the issues we were talking about earlier coincided with Eid.
Yeah.
Sort of the festival of Eid, which marks the end of Ramadan, and
yeah.
So that clearly was timed to yeah. go with that. Yeah. So now, why wouldn't they wait until after the party? It seems like Eid is the party. Yeah. Why would you want to not at least get through the party before you start blowing things up again?
Well, yeah, you would think that would be the case. But again, I think the logic path doesn't follow. But
yeah.
there's very little that's logical about it now, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think it's sort of interesting to see how they... And even now, like the other day I was in the news and we were talking about... I was talking about the differences in sort of in how the Al-Qaeda and all these various groups have sort of changed. And, you know, one of the news, I won't say the person's name, asked, well, is this, you know, was the president naive and the Obama administration naive about when he said that, you know, they cut off the head of the snake and therefore Al-Qaeda's mm-hmm. dead, you know, et cetera. And I said, well, they may have, I don't think it was a bit of naive. I think they were thinking we did hurt them. We did hurt Al-Qaeda. I said, it's not the same Al-Qaeda. It's highly decentralized now. But just cutting off the head of the snake, we thought that if we killed the financial aspect, that would kill their ability to buy people mm-hmm. to join their cause. And that's what Al-Qaeda has done historically, that they buy people.
Yeah.
You know, people don't join because they love it. They join either to save their life or they join because they're giving you money to fight for their cause. You know, that's almost like mercenaries. They hire people to do the job, right? So now it's so decentralized, it's changed the dynamic because... In all the different areas, they may make a phone call or they don't talk to each other, so they have different operational capacities.
Yeah.
And that changes the discussion completely because we can't just go to one spot and cut off one head of the snake. Now we have a hydra.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a problem. It's a problem.
And they're more cause-oriented and less financially oriented.
Exactly. Exactly. And when you have religious terror and religious, you know, it's a lot different than when you have secular terror or nationalist terror because... A nationalist, like the IRA, you could give them something and get something to bargain with. With religion, it's a psychological and emotion-based notion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether you're religious or not, I mean, you stem from a spot that deals with something that's unseen. It's based on a philosophical and emotional-based notion. So what happens is... There's no point of rationalization. Mm-hmm. You know, your point is they think they're martyring themselves. Some of them martyr themselves in the name of God and of Allah. And so for them, it's like that's their reward. Well, I can't bargain with you if that's what your reward is. I have nothing to give you that can satisfy you to make you want to change or change your stance. So there's no way to bargain with people like that.
Yeah.
You know, that's what makes religious terror much more difficult to deal with than secular or nationalist terror. Much more complicated.
Mm-hmm. So, I suppose that takes us back. We should bring Jack in to talk about Snowden. So Jack is a computer software developer.
So I can get on.
All right, we can share. So you tell me what you do, and then how you understand what Snowden was doing before he. You know, started his whole thing.
Well, currently I'm just a lowly software developer, but it doesn't take a lot of understanding to understand exactly what Snowden was doing if you have some knowledge about...
Well, dumb it down for me.
Computer programming and
you how software dumb works. It down for me.
Just for him. You can dumb
just
it down for him.
Me. For me, you can. I'm an idiot. He'd get it.
But wait a minute! You both know what I do.
Yeah, I know. I'm just, But
okay,
you know
you're fishing here.
You
want to know that I make online stores.
No. I want you to dumb down what Snowden did. He was part of a military contractor.
Right. Okay. I did know that.
That analyzed and took in huge amounts of data from everyone mm-hmm. and did this large network analysis.
And then he released information about the system that allows them to
the system worked.
Right. Okay.
Whereas Manning released the information from the system, Snowden's releasing information about how the system works,
right.
and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So Manning released like diplomatic communiques, things like that,
right.
sort of personal communication. Whereas Snowden is releasing this is how this entire system of global eavesdropping functions.
Mm-hmm.
Now we were talking last night, and you were comparing it to Facebook.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's how it's really just data mining. So first, just kind of explain what data mining is and pretend I'm, you know, a third grader.
Well, for the most part, data mining is taking just the information that's generated by people's normal movements on the internet or on their cell phones or whatever, and using that information to figure out more information about what they think might happen in the future or how they might better use their assets to make money based on what they know about what other people want. And they can do certain correlations between people buy one thing and they buy another thing, and therefore they will probably buy something else.
But you could easily expand that to ideas as well. But you think one way, and your friends think this way, you're most likely going
to
think
along
these lines.
It doesn't necessarily have to be things that you're buying. It could be things that you're talking about, or just the way that you interact with certain people. There's lots of different semantic markers for people's activity. And
what's a semantic marker?
It's basically anything that signifies a certain kind of activity that can be correlated to another type of activity.
Okay.
You can use these pieces of information to glean other information from it. And that's basically what the NSA collects the data for. My analogy to Facebook was, we all use Facebook, or most people do, and we're generating all of this data all the time. And, you know, Facebook, I'm sure, buys and sells some of this data. I know that you as a corporation, if you sign up to their thing or whatever, you can gain access to some of that information so that you can better market your product. It's the same thing. The NSA would take that same kind of data and decide how they're going to search for terrorists, or how or if they think that there might be terrorist activity happening somewhere, or if there's, you know, just stuff going on, they can figure stuff out based on a group of people's activities, not on just an individual's, just through correlation. It's not necessarily they're following one individual person that they think is a wrongdoer or whatever. They might just look for patterns in the data, looking for some extra information. And that's basically what these large-scale systems are for. It's just gathering information and then doing correlation.
So you're saying you're looking for a causal pattern, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So how much, I mean, that's an awful lot of info.
Right.
So do they write programs then to analyze this information? I mean,
yeah, generally speaking, no human being is just going to be going through this information. There are systems where they'll use what's called visualization, where they will write programs that allows them to look at the data in different ways, and that's where the human will come into it, mm-hmm. and they'll be able to see with the human eye.
So like the word clouds.
Yeah, stuff like that. And they'll be able to see with the human eye and make their own associations that way. But for the most part, it's just done through semantic analysis and correlation and stuff like that.
And so when they do that, how do they identify individuals that are worth looking at more closely?
Well, I mean, they just follow the patterns. Like, they'll see patterns of keywords or patterns of just different types of activity. And eventually, some of those patterns might lead to an individual. And then they'll go and they'll investigate that individual.
Now, we were talking also about how the Snowden situation is very different than the Manning situation, right? Manning was in the military, and then he released, you know, specific communications, whereas Snowden talks to the machine that kind of analyzes how these things are communicated. So it's kind of very different situations. You know, and once you're in the military also, you kind of lose the opportunity to choose what to do in
a
lot of ways.
You sign your life away.
Yeah, you become a different class.
You lose your sovereignty or whatever.
Yeah,
as a person.
Yeah, you do.
And you also lose your ability to be able to just openly communicate about private information. And that includes whether you're a contractor or whether you're, you know, whether you're actually a viable member of one of these intelligence communities.
The thing is, you don't actually lose it. you just, the penalties are probably greater.
Yeah, exactly.
Where Snowden could have decided to quit at some point in time had he not. But, I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean if he believes that what's going on is wrong, this is still something that should be brought to light. And that's, he's having a bigger kind of, or at least he's trying to portray himself as having an ethical issue with this system. Now, there's that network analysis, which is what kind of what the government is trying to push. And then they say they use that network analysis to identify individuals, and then they can basically get into anybody's personal traffic that they decide they want to go after for whatever reason.
Right.
At that point.
I mean, they have all of this data. If an individual wanted to look for information about a single human being, they could do that. It would just be very difficult for them to track it down.
Well, it would be difficult for them to track down, like, the individual. If they already knew they wanted to track... Let's say he decided that he didn't like you and wanted to go after you. He could find that info on you.
Obviously that's a crime, and if they went after you, then, you know...
That's what Snowden is saying.
Right.
Is that that's what the NSA was doing. Without warrants, without even FISA court warrants.
Well, some of this has to do with how much we've demanded of the government or how much... we've allowed to happen, you know, within the last decade or so, with regards to our freedoms.
Yeah. And, 9/11.
I don't like to talk about 9/11 because everyone talks about 9/11.
Exactly.
We need to heal, I think.
Absolutely. But that's where the paradigm shift.
That is really one of the big paradigm shifts. Yeah. I mean, I think it's been leading up to that for even before 9/11.
Absolutely.
But it was a good excuse for them to just take away a lot of our freedoms. Yeah, it's pretty much all I have to say.
Well, I mean, do you think it's more significant? Like, if you look at the two cases between Manning and looking at Snowden, do you think it's more significant to give away how the operation works? In other words, how the data mining and how the access to information and how sort of that functionality, is that more damning? Or do you think it's more the case of what Snowden did, which was by basically providing information? You think one's more damning than the other?
Personally, I think the more data that's out there, the better. You know, I'm not against people. If they know something and they want people to know about it, I think they should be free to do that.
Can I make a comment about that?
Yeah, sure.
But in doing so, and I generally kind of agree with that to a point, but because of the potential of skewing information... what we call misinformation or disinformation.
Or just lying?
Or disinformation. You know, there's a risk of me giving you information, it not being quite accurate, but then you make decisions about your life and the livelihood of our country and our planet based on whatever information is being reflected back to you. So then there's a danger in there, you know. That's where the scary part about information flow comes to me, is the fact that there's such a risk of somebody giving you the wrong information. For example, if you flip the channel to Fox News and you get, you know, and I mean National Fox, and that's what you watch, and that builds your belief system. And then after you watch that first, and then you go over here to MSNBC, which is more liberal, and you get that view of the picture, and everybody's got their own slight skew, where do you go with that? And I think that's the danger. That's a little bit of the scary part of this over-information society we live in today. And everybody wants instant answers to the questions. So that really complicates, you know, how information is communicated and also how it's received. So I can get you to buy, drink the Kool-Aid any way I want. But we use a term called genuflection, right? When I reflect back to you what I want you to believe. Mm. So you watch a TV show, the guy's holding a can of Coke. Well, that can of Coke, if you get to see the Coca-Cola on the can, Coke paid a lot of money for you to see that Coca-Cola on that can. Otherwise, they blur it out. That's why they do that. So it's like subliminal programming, and the same thing happens with communication, and it's easy to do now. And a lot of times when I talk to people who are on either side of the political aisle, you ask them, so why are you a conservative, or why are you a Republican, or why are you a Democrat or liberal? And most people, it's what they saw on TV, or maybe what mom and dad said from 40 years ago that what drove them down that road. Not that they have any real solid basis for why they stand where they stand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they saw something, and then what happens when you give them information that totally is different from what they know to be true? Most people don't handle that well. Strangely enough, people don't handle that change well when they get shocked, get slapped with the reality factor.
Well, honestly, I think most of the time, you have to rely on what evidence is there rather than relying on complete hearsay. I mean, you can probably put some stock in what people say, but generally speaking, unless there's actual evidence there, you probably shouldn't just put all your eggs in that basket.
Yeah, and sadly, because we live in with the Cliff Notes to life now, we live in a day where people want instant information, but they don't want all the information. They want this much. So they synthesize everything in a paragraph or short paragraph to think that they can make decisions about everything in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Very dangerous way to live your life with that much information, because it's not enough. You know, it's just not enough. But that's what people make decisions on. I've had people look at a paragraph about, they'll take the Cliff Notes of Marx and be able to think and be able to BS their way through a brief conversation about Marx, Karl Marx.
Or the Bible,
for instance. Or the Bible or anything, right? But then what will happen is, but you put them against somebody from 100 years ago who had to read Marx or had to literally read the Bible, and then once you go beyond that superficial level up here, you lose them. They can't, the person today on average can't.
But then I think the big problem too is then how do you take people with that knowledge base, right? And then that kind of takes us back to Snowden. There's people like you who kind of understand what was going on technically, and then there's people in Congress who really have no clue what went on technically, and they had their one vote and all that, but now, you know, oh well, the system works, you know, chatter exists, therefore, you know, let's not cut this thing now, but you know that system existed to begin with, you know, and kind of trying to get everyone to understand what is actually going on is an entirely different
problem. I think the real bottom line is to understand, like, how much do we want to be protected by our government, and how much do we want to be suppressed by our government?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
it's a very powerful statement. You know why? After the Kent State massacres in 1970, where they killed four college kids at Kent State, one of the faculty there, a sociologist, said, you know, in this democracy, we have to constantly be able to debate the question of how much power is available to be used against us. Mm-hmm. So when you go to challenge, when you go, you know, the paradigm, the defense of democracy around us, and it might be a bigger fence in other countries, but you never know how much power or freedom you have until you push against the fence. Mm-hmm. And when you find out, when you do that, if you push against it, that they push back, like in Seattle, 1999, WTO. Mm-hmm. Same thing happened. People thought they could go and protest and against what was happening with the WTO.
Or during the Occupy protests.
Exactly. And people found out very quickly that, you know, that there is an infrastructure in place to make sure that you can't do that. And that's a pretty scary notion when you talk about, you know, it's the idea of democracy in our country versus the actuality of what it's become in our country. And other countries, too. But in our country, particularly, you know, the truth of what democracy is and the truth about what it isn't. And people have a hard time with that.
And people are taking that kind of idea into the sort of the digital sphere where you have these digital protesters and digital sit-ins, which are kind of like people who willingly allow their computers to activate denial of service accounts to go after specific websites and things like that. So all those things seem to be kind of pervasive in the world, and they're trying to find ways to shut it down within the sort of the internet world, within the digital world.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know if that's possible at this point. I mean, it can be. The Chinese shut it down.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the Chinese control.
Flip the switch.
There's how many? There's a few lines that come in. There's centralized. Yeah. They control when info gets out there.
Yeah.
Well, from my point of view, I don't know all of the details about what our government has or what they don't have. Nobody does, except for the government. But I would not be surprised at all if what we have is not too dissimilar from what the Chinese have. You know, I mean, as far as, like, surveillance or the ability to turn it off or the ability to, you know, track people down and all that stuff, I'm sure we have all the same stuff. We just use it in different ways.
Yeah.
You know?
And not drastically different ways, by the way.
You
know, not that different, really. Really not that different, so... I mean, but it's interesting because, and here's the thing, I mean, here's a difficult question. If the NSA wasn't doing what it was doing, for whatever reasons it was doing it, you know, where did the risk factor go, right? Mm-hmm. And then the question is, so if the NSA said, okay, we won't do it anymore, wouldn't we just use, like, British intelligence or somebody else to go and do the work that they did anyway?
I can guarantee they're not going to stop doing any of it. Yeah, they've been doing it.
Yeah, forever.
Since they came into existence, exactly. You know, in the 40s or whatever.
Yeah. It's not going away.
Yeah.
The National Security Act of 1947, is not going to change. You know, has created what we live with today, and it's not going to change. And, you know, many people in the country though would say that this is okay. I'm willing to give up my civil liberties in order to save me from the boogeyman.
Right.
And that's the scary thing that's the unfortunate aspect about terrorism that has really damaged our country. It's a psychological effect. And when people are willing to give up their civil liberties, the danger in that is that you may never see them again.
But how much of it is actual terrorism and how much of it is, just talk?
Manufactured, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, again, but because of that talk, people change, people respond to that psychologically. And so it really changes the context of the citizens, and so they can control the population with fear.
Yeah,
it's easy to do. Remember how they had all the different alerts here: amber, red, purple, green, whatever the hell color they had.
Yeah.
Every time they had a big issue about that when Kerry was running against Bush. Remember, because whenever Kerry's numbers started going up, one of the things that
they would raise the
threat level or whatever threat condition.
And every time that happened, Kerry's numbers dropped down, and Bush's levels went up. They have it. This is not me saying it. This is proven, right?
Yeah.
This is not me saying this. And so the question came, well, certainly it shows people thought that Bush could protect them. And it showed this, and remember how Bush kept going that anti-Kerry, that Kerry wasn't really the person strong enough, even though he's a military guy, he wasn't the guy who could protect them from the boogeyman. So,
can anybody really protect us from the boogeyman if the boogeyman really wants to do something to us?
Yeah.
That's the thing about what you were talking about earlier with if people want to hurt groups of people, they can just do it.
Right.
It doesn't take much anymore. Yeah. Right? It doesn't take a lot. You don't need a lot of financing.
They can do a better job of protecting you in a sort of broad way, but who can say if today you decide to use your cup of coffee has some nitro in it or something, you decide you just want to go crazy, your girlfriend broke up with you, and now you're mad. I mean, you might be good 90% of the time, but who knows if you pop and flip a switch today and you're crazy. I mean, that's what you can't predict. You cannot predict that person. So, you can do a better job, but anybody who tries to say you were 100% safe would be lying through your teeth. There's just no way to do that.
So are we headed towards some sort of technological dystopia?
I don't know. I think if we ever get to the technological dystopia, it'll be very gradual and we won't...
You won't even know you're there?
Yeah, we
it's
won't even...
like getting into jacuzzi slowly.
I mean, we're probably... we're probably moving... into it, what we in the future we'll probably think what it is actually dystopia, but it's really just reality at that point. I mean, we're probably in dystopia now.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it distresses me. It distresses me in my classes, and when I see people and young kids, and all they do is they're so socially retarded in many ways now. They're just, I just can't get over. Nobody, life exists through this, through this, and I think it's unfortunate. We're just becoming a socially.
Well, what's so bad about that?
Well, because I think it's good to be able to sit here and go get a chance to meet you. And
sure, but that's
you
what you've been used to your whole life.
Yeah, and I think it's scary to think about sitting in your house all day and just kind of like, aha, I've fallen in.
Maybe we're evolving into a machine,
Damn kids.
I hope I'm dead by that time. Honestly.
Damn kids these days.
I know. Right. We'll all be Tron, right?
Right. I don't know. I'm not particularly worried about it. I mean, if we are evolving into this new mecha species or whatever, then it's the next step in our evolution. I mean, why push it away? I mean, we've made it this far.
Or maybe we're going in cycles where we go through cycles of great achievement, and then we get slapped back to reality, and then we keep going through cycles.
We have to do that. That's natural selection.
Yeah.
In action.
Yeah. There's a future dark age.
Yeah.
Right.
So that makes it very, very problematic. Incredibly problematic. So it'll be interesting to see what the future holds for us. I mean, regarding to this NSA issue, but also just as a society, how we respond to these types of issues and what we can perceive as being acceptable versus those things that we think that are not acceptable with these types of situations. I think it's going to be interesting to see how it pans out. These guys aren't going away.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, our little buddy.
Well, I wish I could, man.
Yeah.
I know, man.
Well. There you go.
Another beautiful Sunday.
Did you want your microphone back?
No, that's okay. You can keep it. I get to hold it all the time. So.
Right.
With all the trolleys and interesting characters in the background.
Yeah, we're going to try and find some interesting historic places in San Diego to meet every week so we can kind of like do this from some really kind of cool places that have a little mystery.
This was originally built to bring people back from the building the Panama Canal. Yeah. So this has been around for a long time now. And at one point, I think in the 30s or 40s, they wanted to replace it as because of the war movement. They needed more capacity, but San Diegans wouldn't allow it. Yeah. Wouldn't allow it to happen.
Well,
so I'm glad.
Place. I mean, after World War II, a lot of the people, this is where people got on the train to go back to wherever they had to get back to. You know, this is a, you know, the Broadway here was a haven for the Navy back in those days. Even back into the 70s and 60s, it was all Navy military right through here. It wasn't like this at all. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's pretty interesting to see how it's changed. It might have been a little sleazier, a little bit dirtier, but I don't know. It had a little charm to it, too. I don't know. Something about it was kind of cool back in the old days.
There is still some of that element here.
Yeah, the YMCA is up the street still, you know. The old
Dude, and it's a hotel now. It's a fancy hotel.
In that pool down in the basement.
They took out that whole pool down there.
They did?
Yeah. The pool's gone.
Oh, man.
And they put in the downtown Y is downstairs in there, and they made it all classrooms and then completely dismantled the old pool. Because it was one of those cool old pools with the little like inch tile, the whole thing. The whole thing was that way.
I swim down there and that smelly, that it had something special about that place, you know. A lot of people, a lot of history there. People don't appreciate that as much these days, but when it's all gone, I mean, they appreciate it. Yeah. So.
Until next time, I guess.
Next week.
Hear the fountain in the
great week.